I do want to do today focus on primarily on Nicaragua, and I'd like to start just very briefly by giving a little bit more of the geography, just very briefly, and a little bit about the history again of the last, especially the last 50 years. And then I'm going to show some slides of a trip that I took a little over a year ago. And hopefully through those slides, it's not going to be a travelogue so much as picking out particular places. I mean, part of it is, but picking out the places that I went and particular people that I talked to and trying to share information through those slides primarily. And then we'll have hopefully plenty of time after that to talk and discuss probably about half the session. We'll be open to that. So just to start with, this is probably, let me pull this closer for right now. Probably we'll see. There are some maps also in the slides. But Nicaragua is right in the Central America. It's bordered on the north by Honduras. This is the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and this is Costa Rica. And then El Salvador is up here, Guatemala is further north. It is really divided right down the middle in two very, very distinct areas. And that's important to know for some of the things that are going on in Nicaragua right now. If you go right down where this gray border is, on the west side of the country, is where most of the population is, and that population is Spanish-speaking, that's primarily European descent population, and it's also it's fairly mountainous, quite lush areas in terms of vegetation, but not near as wet as this side, which is primarily all jungle, lowlands, and through that are sort of run through with all these rivers here. Most of the population on the Atlantic coast is, it's a mixture. It's Mosquito Indians, who are some of the indigenous people, and it makes up a large part of the population. Throughout this part, and then right along the coast itself are more black people, and they speak English. There's more of a descent there from the Caribbean and English-speaking peoples from the Caribbean that settled along the coast here, descendants of former slaves, many of them. So it's very distinct, and some of you may have heard about some of the problems and issues around the Mosquito Indians and the treatment of the Sandinistas from of the Mosquito Indians. And we can talk about that later. I don't really want to get into that right now. But most of the population is here. I did not go into this part of the country. In fact, you cannot go essentially by road all the way from this part of the country to the coast. You have to fly or walk. I mean, as far as you can go is a road right here to Rama. And I guess you can actually, I think now you can get over to Bluefields, actually. But most of the country is inaccessible by road. I went to a little place called Bocana de Paiwas, which is right here, and that is literally the end of the road. If you wanted to go anywhere beyond that, and it wasn't a much of a road to that, but if you wanted to go.
Do I understand you correctly that this population is predominantly Caucasian? In West Nicaragua?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Spanish speaking. Well, they would be mixed in many ways. The way we would see is mestizos, but I think more Caucasian. So that's just generally sort of a look at the map. And just very quickly on sort of the history, it's some of those of you who saw the film strip last night, we'll remember some of this, but just a quick review. The United States actually did occupy Nicaragua in the early part of this century up until late 1920s, I think it was 1929 or 30 when the Marines actually left. The Somoza dictatorship started during that time. Sandinista was a, Sandino, I'm sorry, Augusto Cesar Sandino was a man who led a rebellion against the U.S. Marines and later against Somoza. And that's where the name Sandinista, that was in the late 20s. He was assassinated soon after the U.S. Marines left. Then in the, so Somoza, and then the Somoza family, with first with one and then two sons, ruled the country until 1979. Essentially in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, what you have throughout all of Central America is a time where there actually was economic progress, but in that progress you have inequalities as to who is progressing. You had the differences in wealth grew and grew because there was there were quite a bit of organizations, international organizations that were putting money into the region and trying to develop the economy, and some people benefited from that. Many did not. So you still, you have a situation where you have very rich and very poor, and then those people who are the wealthy tend to repress those who are not, simply to keep control. And that's really sort of the recipe for revolution. The revolution in Nicaragua really continued all the way from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s in very, very small numbers. I mean, it wasn't that significant. It was really in the mid to late 60s that it started being organized in a more formal way, in a more effective way. But even then, it really was not a cause for any alarm for Somoza. And the real turning point, and I think this is important to know, was in 1972, there was a huge earthquake that really devastated the whole city of Managua, which is the capital of Nicaragua. Managua is right here, and that's by far the largest city in the country. And I'll show you some slides in a minute and talk a little bit more about that. But essentially, about $8 million of international aid poured into the country for relief. And essentially what happened was that people found out that Somoza pocketed a large percentage of that money. Well, you'll see in my slides that the city of Managua has never been rebuilt. The downtown section is still in ruins. And that is what really started turning the tide in Nicaragua, because up until that time, most of the middle and upper class people in the country supported the government. But it was when that happened that more and more of the middle class people started turning against Somoza. And that grew over time. It was a coalition of many different groups in the mid and late 70s that joined together, many Christian groups involved as well. And finally, 1970, Somoza was overthrown. And since that time then, we have what we call the Sandinista government, which has gone through various phases itself. The first 5 years were run by a junta of primarily three men, which Daniel Ortega was one. And then there were elections held in 1984, and Daniel Ortega was elected president of the country. And there is a legislature now. They had promised elections. So that's very, very quick sort of rundown, just so we can start. Are there any questions about
is
that?
Is Somoza still living?
No. I can't remember where he went. But he died very soon after. He was not killed, but he died.
Is there any idea what happened to that wealth when he died?
I will talk about that. Much of it left. He and his family got about $1.5 billion out of the country. I can say right now, I mean, under Somoza, these are just a few statistics just so you understand what the situation was like. 18% of the arable land in the country was owned by the Somoza family. Almost one-fifth of the land that you could grow anything on was owned by just their family. And they also owned the 26 largest companies in the country. 1 to 2% of the people Somoza plus others own 50% of the land. So 50% of the land was owned by 98% of the land. Many people own no land at all. And also in 1976, according to a U.S. report, 57% of the children under 4 were malnourished. So the health care was pretty atrocious. And also most of the 50% of Nicaragua's trade and 90% of its aid came from the United States. I mean, we really held up the Somoza dictatorship is what it really involves. If you were a peasant in 1977 in Nicaragua, you probably Okay, let's look at these slides, and I'll talk quite a bit more while the slide. Carolyn, could you get the lights, and I'll turn this on. What I plan to do is to mention a lot of things and not go into a lot of detail, just simply for time. Hopefully enough to where it makes some sense. And what I'd like to do is then afterwards to open that up to discussing more in detail the particular things that you're the most interested in. I think perhaps that's the best way to do this when we have primarily one session.
Okay, and please feel projected noise. Can you keep your voice up?
Okay. And also, at the same time, if you want to ask questions while we go along about any particular clarification, please feel free just to speak out and do that. Okay, just to start with, again, just the map of Nicaragua as it sits in Central America, just so you have a feel for where we're talking about. This is not a particularly good shot, but this is... the map of Nicaragua itself. The pin is pointing to Managua, which again is the capital city, the main city in the country, which is the first place where anyone would go. This is downtown Managua in the present time. This is 15 years after the earthquake, but that's what the earthquake damage was. It's a very odd city. There really is no downtown. There are little barrios, they call them, or little neighborhoods in different sections of the town, and to go from one section to another is almost like going through the country in a way, in parts of it. It's very strange, but primarily because it was destroyed in the middle. You can see these are all buildings destroyed by the earthquake. This was the National Cathedral, also destroyed by the earthquake and never rebuilt. This is inside the cathedral. People always wanted their pictures taken. And right next to the cathedral is the National Palace, which is now essentially government offices. A lot of people in there going to get all sorts of documents and papers and taking care of taxes and whatever. This is also quite near where the palace just was. You'll see political posters all over the place. And this essentially says, for the country, for the peace, for the... I can't read this other section, but anyway, we... anybody else speak... Does anybody speak Spanish?
What is this verse? The red, white, and
blue
thing.
That's peace. It's a dove of peace. You see a lot of peace signs. At the same time, there are a lot of political statements about the sort of unity of the people. You also see a lot of opposition political party posters. I mean, we have this idea that there's no voice of opposition in Nicaragua. There are political parties that have billboards all over the place that are essentially like us having our own political parties and different ones. it's important to know that the Sandinistas now are not, are a political party, essentially, within the government of Nicaragua. There are other parties that also have representatives in their legislature. At the same time, and we'll see some contrast in a minute when we go outside of the city, in Managua, this is the Intercontinental Hotel that sits right in the middle of some very poor areas. This is the pool.
Who built that?
The Intercontinental Hotel chain, American company, I assume. It was built in the early 70s, I think. Again, for the wealthy, the elite. Okay, and mixed in through these are particular people that I had a chance to talk with, and I'll just sort of mix these in and talk a little bit about who they are and what they said. This is CEPAD. CEPAD is the essentially sort of a Protestant Council of Churches in Nicaragua. It began in 1972 as a relief organization after the earthquake. Now it does a lot of relief work, health care, as well as lay ministry training, that sort of thing, all throughout the country. We talked to Gustavo Parajon, who is a medical doctor and also one of the directors of CEPAD. He was educated in the United States, speaks fluent English. He spoke about a number of things, but I particularly wanted to talk about his statements on the healthcare and the educational system in the country. And I mentioned last night some of the gains that have been made since the revolution in 1979. I mean, he, again, is somebody who does not, he says, I don't think the Sandinistas' government is perfect, the party. I disagree with some of the things, but by and large, I support our government. And I mean, this is a Christian man who has been doing relief and medical work in the country for a long time, and he is overall quite pleased with what is happening. Again, the infant mortality rate has dropped about a third. The literacy rate has gone from 32% to about 88% since that time. There are twice as many health clinics and schools as there ever was before. Those are the things that he talked about. Yes?
His wife is American. I mean, they met in the
right.
States when he was going to school. And she was telling us just an example of how the opposition can speak out, or those against. Their daughter goes to an international school where most of the Nicaraguan teachers there, or many of them, are in the upper class or upper middle class, who are becoming very disillusioned with the Sandinista government because they aren't able to get things, and even though they have money, they can't get any more than the next person because things aren't available. And they make it very difficult for her in class sometimes because they know her father's head of CEPAD, so they assume he supports the government, and they make it very clear they are in opposition. And so it emphasizes again how the opposition is able to speak out.
Yeah, that was always my experience, that no one feels threatened by speaking against the government there, as we often hear. After spending just a couple days in Managua, I, by the way, was with a group called Witness for Peace. I should say that if you want to talk more about what that organization is, we can do that too. Witness for Peace is a coalition of North American religious groups that's very concerned about what we're doing in Nicaragua and actually sends people there to be sort of witnesses to North Americans who do not agree with U.S. policy. But this is PIWAS. Which is what our destination was. This is taken out of, this is not a very good shot, it's taken out of a bus window on a very bumpy road. But you can just see, I was not expecting the country to be as beautiful and as mountainous as it is. I happen to love mountains. It's probably one of the reasons I'm beholden, but it's a beautiful place. Let me see if I can. And this is just along the way, we met this man who wanted to, who was very adamant about showing us his church, which was only about 20 yards from where I took that first picture. which is an Assemblies of God church. And I show this primarily because one of the issues that a lot of people are raising in Nicaragua is that sort of mysteriously at first, there seems to be a lot of money flowing into the country for very fundamentalist churches. And there have now been some connections made through the U.S. Embassy in terms of directing some of that money. And probably, I mean, I can't verify this, there's certainly suspicion that the CIA is somehow involved with that. What most people would say is that all of a sudden these very, very poor fundamentalist groups are getting money from seemingly nowhere. The theology of that is essentially to say that in the midst of a country where there's a lot of very liberating kind of theology going on and people who are very politically involved because of their faith, the more fundamentalist churches are much more prone to a theology of the afterlife. That it doesn't matter what happens now, we just suffer what is here and accept what comes later. And so there's a sense that some people feel like that there's almost an anti, sort of a counter-revolutionary force going on here by funding fundamentalist religious groups. I don't know that much about that, but that was something that we heard several times while we were there.
You're saying then that they would be more supportive of the Sandinista regime?
No, I'm saying they would be less supportive. They would be less concerned about any kind of real social change and less supportive of a government that is trying to really reform the economy and reform the distribution of wealth. And so therefore, people who want to overthrow the Sandinista government at this particular time are essentially funding these groups, hoping that they will expand and grow. This was the inside of the church. This is a little town called Rio Grande. I'm sorry, Rio Blanco. There's another place called Rio Grande. Which is, believe it or not, one of the more prosperous towns in the entire region. This is a place where there were some larger farms in the area. We stayed here a night because the road from here to Paiwas is unpassable after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because we were going into the midst of one of the most war prone areas of the country at that particular time. That's what Witness for Peace does. And the road had actually been closed for about 10 days prior to our coming. We were told that there was probably no way we were going to get to Paiwas, but we came there anyway. And had quite a session tonight. This is the group I was with, essentially saying that anyone who did not feel like they wanted to go on could certainly decide at that point not to continue because of any particular danger. The philosophy of Witness for Peace is, however, that the Contras would never intentionally attack a group of North Americans because their funding is coming from the U.S., that the publicity of that would be too negative for them, and therefore they would not take that risk. Therefore, Witness for Peace goes into areas that are in the midst of the war, hoping to give people a little bit of relief for at least a period of time, so knowing that the Contras would probably not attack while we were there. At least that's the hope. Everybody did decide to go. We loaded up 25 people in these two trucks. Drove out of town. The road actually did open up. There was very clear that the Contras knew we were there because it was the first time it had been open in a week and a half. We were able to go. It's not much of a road. You have four-wheel drive vehicles to get there. It takes about an hour. I throw this in. This was our first upset stomach victim here. So he's got a mouthful of Pepto-Bismol. In the way. And this is Paiwas, which is a very small, very, very poor village Literally, as I said, it's at the fork of two rivers. If you want to go anywhere past that, you either have to walk or go by horseback. These are just some of the people there. It's a village that 5 years ago had a population of 500. The population now is 2,500. 2,000 of those people are refugees from the mountains. The Contras' strategy has been to come down through the mountain corridors where they cannot be as easily traced and to attack small groups of people and just harass them. And these are people who just finally gave up, felt like they could not protect their farms on their own, and they left and came to the town for protection. These are some of those people. They now just live all throughout the center of the village in little shacks. The village has welcomed them with open arms and is really trying now to get more aid for food and housing. We'll see that in a minute. We stayed in families while we were there. This is probably the most substantial house in the entire village. These people do not own it. They are refugees themselves, and this house was vacant, and the woman who owns it lets them stay there. These are just some of the people in the family. It's essentially sleep in hammocks, which they then pull up during the day so they can use the room and then put the hammocks down at night. This is Sebastiana. She used to get up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'd hear the grinder going, and she'd ground cornmeal and then patted out all the tortillas and made fresh tortillas every morning for breakfast over a wood fire. Piwas is, I should say, the other way of transportation from there is down the rivers. It is the closest place for health care and for a school. These people are coming. This woman is bringing her baby to the health center, which is this, which did not exist before the revolution in 79, nor did the school exist before that time. There simply just were not any health centers or any schools in this place before that time. This is Father Jim Feltz, who is an American priest who's now been in Piwas as their priest for about 6 years. Most of the priests in Nicaragua are not Nicaraguans because the educational level has been so low that they have not been able to produce enough of their own priests who are educated. He spent some time in Peru and then in Chicago doing urban ministry and has been back in Nicaragua now for about 7 years. He spoke quite candidly about the government and about what he saw happening. Again, he wasn't happy with everything, but overall he was very supportive. He saw the government as really being very sincere about its commitment to the people, about real social change for everyone, about trying to make it a place where everyone did get basic health care and had the basic needs of life. I can talk a lot more about what he said, but we'll move on if you want to ask more about that later. This is a woman named Carmen, who is one of the most articulate spokeswomen on feminism I think I've ever heard. She has about a third grade education, I think, but she spoke about how since 1979 the role of women has changed 180 degrees. And how she is now the head of 5 cooperatives in the town. The culture in Central America is a very male-oriented, macho culture, and yet there really are changes. There are a lot of conferences being held for women and their role, and at the same time, her husband is very supportive of her. She's very involved in the church, as are all of these people who are called delegates of the word. And I will talk more about that tomorrow when we talk about the church and liberation theology. But there's an incredible sense of lay empowerment. When we went to Mass, the priest, Jim Feltz, did nothing in the service except serve the Eucharist. The sermon, the psalms, the baptisms were all done by lay people. These are people who are all trained. They're very committed to the church. They go out into the surrounding countryside and lead Bible study. There's just an amazing kind of fervor about people of faith and their involvement in the church, which is very different from the way it was 15 or 20 years ago when essentially the priest had all of the power. These are some houses that are being built for the refugees. There's a cooperative, two cooperatives in town. And again, I'll just say that cooperatives in Nicaragua are not state-owned for the most part. Some are, but most are owned by the people that run them. There are strict laws of how they're set up, and then when a group of people have met those requirements, they're sometimes given land. And we can talk more about that later if you'd like. We talked to these people, and I guess I want to just relate a couple stories of people's experiences with the Contras. I heard over and over and over everywhere, especially in Piwas, stories of just about everybody I talked to had one at least member of their family who had been killed or raped by Contras. And I believe those stories. I know that those stories were not made up. It's very clear when you talk to someone directly. The man on the right is Isabel. And he relates the story of how his daughter, Cristiana, who's in the green dress, who was 11 when this picture was taken, but 2 years prior to this, they had lived up in the mountains in a little family-owned, sort of a family enclave where they farmed. The Contras came in one day to his brother's house, where Cristiana was at the time. His two brothers were there, and his sister-in-law. They walked in, immediately shot both of his brothers, raped his sister-in-law, and shot her, and then took Cristiana outside and told her to run, and then proceeded to line up and use her as target practice to see who could shoot her first. She was shot 4 times, and I saw those scars. She has one that goes through her hand. You can sort of barely see on her, is on the left side of the screen for us, a scar on the top of her hand. She sort of hides it most of the time. It's slightly deformed. She was shot once there, once in the head, which sort of grazed, once in the shoulder, and once in the lower back. And she was unconscious. They thought she was dead. Miraculously, people came and got her. She spent 6 months in the hospital in Managua, but is quite healthy now. But just a beautiful little girl. But there's story after story after story like that. This woman here has a similar story of how her father and brother were carried off. She walked for about 3 days in the rain to escape them because she was an organizer. Essentially, they target people who are teachers, health workers, and organizers in villages. They're trying to undercut essentially the infrastructure just by harassing people. They're not fighting a war that is really a war as we think of. Anyway, her baby died of exposure because of being wet and cold for 3 days in this walk. Not the one obviously she's holding. And this woman who said, she was 83 years old, and she's had 5, I think it was, of her children who have been killed in the war. The last night we were there, the whole town had a celebration of singing. There's an amazing, I've heard people say this before I went, and I thought it was exaggerated, but there's an amazing sense of faith, hope, and even celebration in the midst of all of this. I mean, this is a town that the night before this, there was a general alarm in the town, and the militia was called out because of military activity in the area. Nothing really happened in town. But now they are all gathering, all the children are there, there's singing going on, there is real laughter. Jim Feltz got up and taught the children how to sing Old MacDonald in English, which is about the funniest thing I've ever heard. They were all repeating, he repeated all the English words and then the Spanish words and having them all doing chicken sounds and thing else. I absolutely loved it. We then left, went back and spent some time on a coffee plantation or a coffee co-op. I should say, this is walking in. You cannot drive to it this particular time of year. A beautiful place up in the hills. There was a Danish group there at the time picking coffee. There's a real shortage of labor right now during the coffee harvest, which is a primary source of income for the country. They were there at the same place while we were there. These are the essentially the members of the co-op. And just to give you some idea, let me just run down. This co-op was originally owned by one man, a quite wealthy person. The government bought the farm from him. And we asked quite a bit of questions here and in Managua about the land reform program. And most of the large farms are still owned by the original owners. There have not been that many. The land is not just being taken. The only time that the government, supposedly at least, has taken land is when either somebody wants to sell it or the land is not being productive. In this particular case, the coffee trees were not being rotated like they need to be for long-term production. In that case, the government is really concerned about the long-term economy of the country and did take the land by paying for it. And actually, we found out what the price was and then checked that in Managua to find out that was a fair price with some people who we thought would know. And they said, well, it's not an extremely generous price, but it's certainly fair. So there is a sense that the person who owned this before was not just being undercut. The land is now owned by these families. It is not owned by the government. The land was given to them and with some low interest loans for them to produce, to use for their production. We spent a day ourselves helping them out and picking coffee. Believe it or not, those are coffee beans. They don't look quite like what we have. This is back in Matagalpa, and I just take this because this is an opposition political party. This is one of the political parties that does have representatives in the legislature. They're not Sandinistas, and there are offices around. There's not a unit. There's not just one party who's running this country. I guess I just want to make clear that. We also visited a prison, and I'll just simply say that Nicaragua has been noted and has actually won some international awards for its prison reform. Very few people, when the Sandinistas took control in 79, there was essentially no one executed. There was not the bloodbath that everyone expected. And in fact, a lot of people who were in prison for a few years, who were some of the most atrocious torturers, have actually now been released. They also have, again, that's another issue that we can talk more about if you'd like. Okay, we also visited some people who are, and talked to a number of people who are opposition people. I shouldn't say a number, I think the majority of the people there are not in opposition. This is a labor union. The Trabajadores is a Spanish word for workers, essentially. This is one of the largest labor unions in the country. This Hakim is his name, is one of the leaders in the labor union. And essentially, I'll just say that he is not very pro-Sandinista or pro-government at this particular point. At the same time, he is pro-revolution, and I think you have to understand that. He was involved in the revolution. He still believes in it, and essentially what he says is, I don't like a lot of things happening right now. I'm not real pleased with the way the constitutional process is going. At the same time, leave us alone. We will take care of the problem. He believed that there was enough democratic process in the country to still be able to work that out on their own. He said, instead of funding the Contras, send us tractors, send us trucks, use that money for equipment and help restore our economy instead of forcing us to put it all into a war that we don't want to fight. He was not, as I said, he was quite adamantly opposed to the Sandinista government, but at the same time, and this was true of everyone I talked to who was opposition, I never talked to anybody who supported the Contras. Now there are some, I'm quite willing to admit. This is Jim Goff, who's a Presbyterian missionary. And the main thing I want to say about him is that he talked about the elections that had been held in 1984. I'm just going to finish up real quick here on the last part. Just to say, without going into a lot of details, that essentially the statement by the Reagan administration has been that the elections held were a sham. He cited three independent reports from international organizations, including the Latin American Study Association, which is a pretty reputable group of professors within the United States who monitored the election, and they said, or he said, that he had been doing mission work in Central and Latin America for 37 years, and as far as he was concerned, they were the fairest elections he had ever witnessed. This is Bishop Vega, who is one of the opposition bishops in the Catholic Church in Nicaragua. He was expelled from the country after this happened, primarily because the government, because he came to Washington and lobbied Congress for Contra aid. Nicaraguan government said that was treason. And if you think about it, that would be like somebody from the United States going to another country and lobbying their government to support a guerrilla movement against our country. And that's the way they saw it. He was expelled from the country. Has since now been let back in. And the contrast to that is Fernando Cardinale, who's a priest. There are four priests who are ministers within the government. He is one of them. He's a minister of education. He's been involved in the government ever since the beginning of the time. And I can talk about him as well if you'd like. I think quite an amazing man. Okay, I'm just going to, I think so we can have some time to talk, just run through these real quickly. After my group left, I spent some time myself traveling alone in the country. Spent some time with another priest who, again, I would say felt similarly to Jim Feltz. I'll just say he's the one on the left. He's a French-Canadian priest, has been there for about 17 years, I think. Spent 2 days with him and with some health workers, young health workers from Nicaragua at a party that he had, and then spent an afternoon driving with him through the mountains. This is a Christian-based community, which again we'll talk about more tomorrow, up in the hillsides. This is a family that we went to visit, quite poor family, obviously. And these are just pictures of a destruction from a Contra attack on Ocotal, which is probably the largest Contra attack of the entire war. Came across those hills, destroyed the radio station, destroyed the coffee. This is the beneficio, where the coffee is stored. I'll just skip that, it's another story. And then I spent some time in a little village helping in a health center. This is a resettlement village, and help. This is a Spanish man who's a nurse volunteering in Nicaragua. And this is a Canadian woman. I gave oral vaccines and they gave the others for a whole day. They just needed help while we were doing it. You can see the conditions, I mean, what they're having to put up with right now. Their drugs are short. They ran out of vaccine. But it's still more than the people ever had before. These are kids that are looking in the window at their friends getting shots. This is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, who will arrive on Friday here at Holden. He will be our program coordinator for the summer. He spent a lot of time in Nicaragua coordinating some educational programs and has written a couple books. He talked a little bit about the economy of the country. And finally, I just wanted to point out, this is Robert McAfee Brown, who was, I felt very fortunate to have in our group. Robert McAfee Brown is a very, very noted theologian and very active in Central America stuff. He wrote a book called Theology in a New Key, which we'll talk about tomorrow again. And I thought since I had a shot of him, I learned a lot from him. And finally, this is the last slide, just to say that for me, I keep coming back to this story of Christiana and feel like no matter what government there is in Nicaragua, that how can we justify supporting the kinds of human rights violations that we are by supporting the Contra. So I'm not trying to hide the fact that I have very definite position on the whole story. Can you reach the lights over there? And we still have about 15 or 20 minutes. Discussion. I know that was a lot of information, and probably it's to have one session we could spend a whole week just talking about Nicaragua, but just running through that, hopefully the slides at least help a little bit to give some grounding to it. And I guess what I would like to do is just see if there are any particular issues that people want to talk about, and then just to add to that, that some of the particular things that I know people sometimes do want to talk about involve everything from the constitutional process. Nicaragua just has written and passed a new constitution within the last year. The whole Mosquito Indian question, the cooperatives, the economy, the private versus socialist aspect of the economy. Censorship has been a real big complaint about Nicaragua, and repression. The draft, the Contador peace process, the Contras, the elections, and the opposition of the Catholic hierarchy to the government. Those are some of the key issues, I guess, that very often are discussed. So I guess I just throw it out to see if there's anything in the slides or anything I've said that you either want to comment on or you disagree with or want to ask questions about, or any of the things that I've just mentioned.
Is there any way to assess the percentage of the population that might be pro-Contra, and I won't say pro-Sandinista, because that second grouping would cover the ones that are not expressed either way. But right. I'm thinking of the expressed Contra movement.
Well, no, I don't think there's any way to know for sure. Most of the information, I was just referred to this yesterday. This is in the newest Newsweek, an article on two, some of you may have read this, two New York Times reporters that spent a month traveling with the Contras, and then spent a month, were invited by the Sandinistas to go to the exact same areas with the Sandinista army. And it's quite an article to read. And essentially they say that, well, the subtitle is Back in the Battle but Losing the War for the People's Hearts and Minds. There have been several reporters now that have spent time with Contras and have spent time out really in the backcountry. There are certainly people who are disenchanted with Sandinistas, and there are people who support the Contras. But I have never heard anybody say that I've never heard a figure more than 10% who even remotely support the Contras. Most of the people who have any opposition to the government have no support for what the Contras are doing. And there's no way I can give a statistic for that. I don't think anybody has, other than just say that if you talk to just about anybody who's been there, or you read stuff of people who've been there, it's real clear that the Contras have very little political base other than themselves. Yeah.
Being that the fruit companies are so important, we get a lot of our fruit from there. Do you feel that the United States is subsidizing the fruit business or expending too much in the military way to protect those interests down there?
Well, actually, we don't get our fruit anymore from Nicaragua because we don't buy anything from Nicaragua. That's a government put an embargo on all Nicaraguan trade about, what was it, probably 3 years ago.
Yeah,
but
the general area.
But yeah, the general area. I certainly think that a great part, a major part of U.S. policy certainly is concerned about protecting U.S. interest in the area, which in a major part of that are U.S. companies. And that's the fruit companies. A lot of it's beef production, too. I mean, McDonald's hamburgers get, I don't know what percentage of it, some major part of their beef comes from Central America, for instance, primarily from Honduras, I think. So there's a lot, yes, I think there's no doubt. And I don't think there's anything necessarily completely wrong with that in terms of just being concerned for our interests, as long as we don't, which I think we are, violating other people's rights to do that, which I think is what's happening.
What would happen if the United States withdrew its support to the countries?
The worst case scenario, and probably what Reagan's administration would say, would be that if we withdraw that the Sandinistas become entrenched, that they would bring in, they would become more Soviet aligned, and we would have a real problem like we have with Cuba. What Nicaragua would say would be that if the United States would really pull out of any kind of military influence like that in the region, that they would get rid of, they would abide by the Contador peace process, and they would expel all of their military advisors from Cuba. If they stay, they've already done that. I think probably most of them have gone, there may be a few. That they would no longer align themselves even as closely as they had with the Soviet Union. And I guess I feel like that they're smart enough to realize that right now that's probably their only way that they're going to survive. That for their own self-interest, regardless of what their political philosophies and inclinations are, that the only way they're going to really survive is to be able to get the United States off their back. And if they have to really non-align themselves to do that, I think they're smart enough to do that. They said immediately after the 1979, through those first few years, they were very clear that they wanted to establish relationships with the United States, and they did not want to align themselves with either the United States or with the Communist bloc. And I guess my opinion is, and it's shared by a lot of people, is that they have become closer and closer and closer aligned with the Soviet bloc as we have forced them to seek military assistance in other places. So essentially, I think that U.S. foreign policy in Nicaragua has forced exactly the situation that we supposedly are fighting against. Because they're in a desperate situation. They're fighting a war. They don't have the resources to do that. They've got to get help from somewhere. And I think politically, philosophically, they certainly are, there is a Marxist element to the government, but it is not entirely Marxist. There's a real blend of Christianity and Marxism in there that it's very hard, I think, for us to understand.
But don't you think over time that might change? I mean, as you mentioned before, after they entrenched, I'm thinking of Cuba now, too, of Castro, you know, how he first was, you know, more democratic, and after he was entrenched, way completely
right.
turned around. And I think that's the United States government, as you mentioned before, that's the main concern.
Right.
And I can see it personally. I hadn't lived that long under a communist regime, but I have been there. And I know that, you know, a communist or a socialist might say something today, but next week, as the situation changes, his opinion or his intentions going to change too.
Right. Well, I think there's that danger. I mean, sure. But I guess I really do believe that there are some differences between Nicaragua and other communist countries. And I think that's what we're not necessarily paying any attention to. I really do believe, I mean, I have spent some time in Eastern Europe. I never lived there, and I'm young, and there's a lot of limits to my own experience. So I'm quite willing to say that. But I do believe that it's not fair to automatically clump together just because of Nicaragua with all of Eastern Europe or other communist countries.
No, but you also can't say that the Eastern Bloc does this out of the goodness out of the heart. They have an intention. If they give them aid, there
absolutely
is an intention.
Absolutely. And we do the same thing.
Certainly, yes.
Okay. Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. There is no doubt about that. But I guess the hope would be, and I really do believe that if the United States would lift our trade embargo and cut all contra aid, essentially it's almost all military analyst would say that if the United States cut off the aid to the Contras, the war would stop because they simply do not have the support to continue. So if that happened and the war stopped and there was really a sincere effort on the part of the United States to at least cautiously begin some kind of relationship with Nicaragua, I think we would find that they would no longer need the degree of support that they now have. I think they would still continue some, and I think at the same time they would welcome some U.S. Influence and aid. I really do believe that. I do believe that it's a different situation, and that they have that there really is an attempt there to not simply become one of the others. Now, you said that a lot. I agree that you can't always trust what everybody says, but I guess I do believe that we ought to at least give them the benefit of that doubt before we just completely destroy a whole country. Yeah.
My own belief is that if the U.S. would pull out, the Soviet Union would have full control of Nicaragua.
Yeah, see, I don't believe that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I disagree with that, but I mean, you're entitled to your opinion, but I firmly believe that that would not...
That happened in Cuba.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm saying is that Nicaragua is not Cuba, and I think a lot of people would say that.
Same pattern.
Well, no, it really isn't. It really isn't. There are a lot of similarities, there's no doubt about that, but I think you will find that the revolution in Nicaragua is much more broad-based, and it's not centered in the personality as much of one person. You don't have that kind of situation. And it's a much different ideology. Now, see, I think that's where it takes a lot of looking at the situation. We have been told by our government that Nicaragua is a communist government. And It is very different from Castro and the ideology there. It is a real mixture. We cannot classify it anymore. It is not Soviet communism. It is certainly has strong elements of what we would call socialism. There are certainly professed Marxists within the government, but within the government you also have people who call themselves they would say they were Christian socialists. They are not Marxists. They are people who, out of their Christian faith, are concerned about the welfare of the people and a fair distribution of wealth. There's a real tempering of the Marxism within the government, And even among the Marxists, there is an openness to listening to the other side that you don't find in some other places. I think she was going to say
yeah,
something.
I had a question. This is in regard to the reporters which got to spend the month with both the Contras and then the Sandinistas. Out of this article, now I haven't read it, but is there any indication as to which groups, Sandinistas or Contras, have more cushions?
I don't. I've only
any statistics given there, or any yeah. experiences like you share. When you were there, you found a lot of cushions among the Sandinistas. And so, what I'm getting at is scripturally speaking, then, and looking at this thing, you know, us helping the Contras, our government helping the Contras. Scripturally speaking, we always think of being told to help our brothers first. Of course, we are to help all people, but you help your brothers first. So as Christians, when we look at it, being guided by scripture, we would just try to find out now where are the more Christian brothers involved. And of course, then again, if there are Christians on both sides, we're really hard put.
Sure.
But
well, there are Christians on both sides. I mean, the Contras certainly cite biblical and religious reasons for doing what they're doing. I find it really hard to support biblically. I think that all kinds of groups and organizations, including studies from U.S. congressmen, there's a whole list of U.S. government studies in terms of the human rights violations of the two different groups, and it is overwhelmingly imbalanced towards the Contras. I find it very hard to believe that you can, out of Christian faith, do the kinds of things they do. But there's no doubt that those people consider themselves Christians, and many are very much people of faith. And so I don't want to argue that the Sandinistas are the people of Nicaragua are all Christian and the Contras aren't. I would never say that.